There's a question. I thought I'd just there's a couple questions, so I thought I would use that as a starting point. Particularly there's a question. Any particular memories or reflections on Lumpa Cha's teachings around Kwa Wat as a basis for practice? considering yesterday was Ajahn Chah's anniversary, sort of recollection of Ajahn Chah. I think the that's a particular part of Ajahn Chah's style, is use of when you say kha wat, it's kind of a broad kind of, you know, so I think Ajahn Jeff translates it as protocols or something, different aspects of training in the lifestyle and ways of living and relating to other people and the requisites and the community, so that actually Ajahn Chah's way of training and teaching had a lot to do with Kwa Wat. These types of trainings and in particular because Ajahn Chah wasn't teaching a method of practice, he was teaching an approach to practice and an attitude towards practice, so that cultivation of these types of attitudes and how we relate to the Dhamma, how we relate to the teachings, and how that's expressed in our daily life, and how we apply it with our relationships with the things around us. And something just first thing that pops into my mind is Ajahn Chah sort of teaching Ajahn Sumedho and not in a direct way, but in setting an example where Ajahn Sumedho has come into the hall every day for the puja and the meditation, and at Wat Bapong when you'd come into the hall, you'd come from your kuti in the forest, and then you'd have your bag with your monk's bag on your shoulder, and have it beside you, and Ajahn Sumedho, as he tells the story, would come in and basically plunk his yam down beside him, and then do his three bows and sit down. And Ajahn Chah, after watching Ajahn Sumedho do that for some time, after he came in, he got up, came over, and picked up Ajahn Sumedho's yam, set it down sort of quietly, and then put it kind of neatly put it down, folded the shoulder part of it, folded it neatly, put it over so it was neat, and then he went back to his seat. He didn't say anything. But it was obvious example of rather than just sort of coming in and plunking yourself down and leaving things sprawled around you, then pay attention to those sort of aspects of how we do things, how we make transitions, how we come into the hall, how we get up and leave. All these things are ways that we express our inner mind state externally, so that sense of developing a continuity of attention and an attitude of care and circumspection with the the things that we're doing. Also looking at things, Ajahn Chah he would always train us to, when a big part of the duties and chores, looking after our kutis, sweeping the trails, keeping the area around us neat and tidy, and like we're sweeping the trails, he'd always be telling us to be, don't be sweeping back and forth across the trails. It's the easiest way to sweep the trail. Just sort of go along, sweep, 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 sweep. But what it does is basically over time, what you're doing is creating a nice trench that builds up the dust on the sides, and then the rainy season comes, and you're walking through this sort of little creek bed. so that he would have the villagers come in from time to time, dig from the sides, build up the trails, and then for sweeping, you'd want sweep from the either sweep along the trail so that the trail's being, or sweep from the sides into the middle, and then take the leaves off, throw them off to the side. So then you're keeping the shape of the trail. And when it comes to be the rainy season, you're not traipsing through mud and a creek bed. So that just that attention to the fact that because it's one thing. Oh yeah, I'm going to go out and do my sweeping, but then what effect does that have? What's the result of that? What's the long-term result of it? And so our actions have results, and it isn't a matter of just fulfilling some external form of doing a chore or a task or a duty, but it's doing it in a way that is attentive and sensitive and recognizing the effects that it has, so that the effects of our actions we need to be attentive to that, and that's a part of the training, is learning how to recognize that. When you live with one with yourself and living with other people, living in community that's dependent on the offerings of the lay community, then there's all sorts of levels of responsibility that we have, and to learning how to attend to that, so that just something simple like sweeping is a way of attending to the needs of the environment and the needs of our personal practice and the needs of the community. So that with the aspects of in terms of call what of communal practice, and Ajahn Chah was put a lot of emphasis on the learning how to practice as a community, learning how to live together as a community, and that he would also give plenty of time for individual practice, but it was balanced by practicing together as a community, so and he would hearken back to teaching of the Buddha in the Parinibbana Sutta of the Sangha being able to last for a long time when meeting together in harmony, coming together as a community, as a group, coming together at the same time, being with each other and then dispersing in harmony, so that sense of when it's time, Ajahn Chah, that when it's time to have group practice, then put your effort into group practice. When it's time to have more individual or solitary practice, and put your effort into that individual and solitary practice, rather than let's say, of course, he did. He had ways of sometimes his methods were almost diabolical says that Ajahn Sumedho came one time because he was wanting to have more. He couldn't understand the talks that Ajahn Chah was giving, and Ajahn Chah was doing a lot of teaching those days, or sometimes you come together and he didn't say much. Sometimes he came together and he gave a lot of instruction, but it was in the evening meetings, and it was never quite clear when the meeting was going to begin and end. And it was not. I mean, it's just you come together to a certain time after the evening, having a shower, and they come together in the evening, and then it was never really clear when it was going to end, and it's just how things are in Thailand oftentimes. And certainly and for Ajahn Sumedho, being a Westerner, it was just driving him nuts. And I don't understand anyway. I don't know when it's going. I could just be at my kuti meditating, so he expressed that to Ajahn Chah, and then Ajahn Chah, the way he kind of announced it. He told the Sangha, Ajahn Sumedho. But he made this whole big production out of it. And basically it was so embarrassing for Ajahn Sumedho that they sort of like, Ajahn, almost, you know, Ajahn Sumedho needs special time. And he's a Westerner, he doesn't. He's not able to understand this and that. And then, so it was a special time for him to meditate. So it was Ajahn Sumedho, he stayed away for, I mean, it was a couple days or something. He just felt so embarrassed by it that he just came back and was plugged into the community. Whatever it was doing, and that was really how Ajahn Chah taught and trained to be just to be able to fit in with what's happening. Put your effort into what the group is doing at the time, and learn how to set aside your personal preferences. Because there's more to be learned from that than there is from getting, you know, ordering your life the way that you want. Because we've been able to do that as lay people, and it hasn't been a particularly successful strategy. So that sense of you know, being willing to put forth effort into the things that are need to be done, what the group is doing, what the community is doing, and how can one send, and that's sort of, there's that lovely discourse of with Anuruddha when the Buddha went to visit Anuruddha and the group of his friends that were practicing in the forest, and that was how they lived together in harmony, was setting aside what they wanted to do personally and looked to see what the others what needed to be done for the well-being of the group. And so that kind of training around or what? It's just not, say, the purpose of it is not having a bunch of rules and protocols to trying to force people into some kind of submission, but it's being able to use these, and this is how Ajahn Chah both taught the Vinaya and these kind of monastic protocols. As a means of, as a mirror for being able to understand volition and being able to understand intention within the mind. Because we can only really start to become free of say, kamma and the entanglements of kamma when we can understand volition and intention, the impulses within the mind. And we usually don't understand that until we've got a bit of a mirror to reflect back what are our intentions, because, you know, whatever mood or feeling or preference comes up in the mind, or view or opinion that comes up in the mind, it wouldn't come up if it wasn't right somehow. in our inner logic, it's what we. What we want, how we perceive things, how things should be, to be able to question that and investigate that and look at it closely. It's where this aspect of having a mirror of these standards of practice and standards of training. That we take on, and being a member of a particular community. They have different communities have different styles and different emphases, different flavors, and there's a particular kind of flavor of Ajahn Chah's training, and it's that has a particular purpose, and to be able to derive the benefit from it is to have to be able to steep yourself in that. And so that these aspects using the kinds of how we how we walk, how we talk, how we interact, how we the duties that we take on, the giving ourselves to it, are opportunities to look more closely at the aspects of volition and intention and the moods that are conditioning our actions and speech and the internal processes of the mind. And because it's one thing to just say that we're going to be mindful of everything, but we tend to need to have some kind of a structure that helps us to see that more clearly, so that as we're in the same way of just like sitting meditation, Ajahn Chah would always be on see, when you sit in meditation, sit up straight. Not just a external posture, it's an internal posture. You're sitting up straight and being present with what you're doing. And to see him when he sat meditation, I was wondering, wonderful. He was just so present and solid. He was just completely there. But he wasn't, he wasn't moving. He wasn't. He was just like a rock. But it was solid like a rock, but it wasn't stiff like a rock. It was just really present. And it's something that he kind of admits or says. I mean, he's never had problems with sleepiness or drowsiness. It just was never a problem in his meditation. He had other problems that he had to deal with, but it was always sort of I don't know why people have problems with meditation and drowsiness. They don't have trouble with drowsiness at other times. I don't see anybody falling asleep when they're at the meal time. You say, why is it when you start a Dhamma talk and not even through the Namo Tassa yet, and people are already nodding? Mahika, which is another kind of, an aspect of how Ajahn Chah kind of held the kawat, the training, the kind of monastic practices. They're there to train with. They're there to put your heart into. But it's also And you say there, he didn't hold it so tightly that it was always a source of stress or worry he always had a sense of humor around things. And just, I mean, one is it, you know, it displays human nature so vividly. I can remember him saying, "Is this, you know, people sort of assume that I can read minds?" And he said, "I don't need to read minds. I need to see how people come into a hall and sit down." You carry your personality with you. You carry your whole backlog of proliferations and preferences, and it's carried in the demeanor. It's carried in the distractions that one is manifesting. So and that's where those call what things are really helpful, because of having something tangible to be putting one's attention on, like walking in a meditation hall, and so rather than sort of thumping across a hall, to be going slowly, carefully, quietly, walking through a hall. It's a particular, say one's doing the same, accomplishing the same thing, walking from point A to point B, but there's a whole different degree of awareness and obsession with oneself that is being displayed. Just mindlessly thumping across a meditation hall is a particular display of certain temperament and habits, conditioning. These are all areas of that are covered in terms of our monastic training, our monastic form, the small things that we attend to. It's something that one is picking up as a training rather than picking up as an obsession, or picking up as a means of criticizing others. These are all to be picked up as a means of self-reflection and investigation and training for oneself, so that to be picking it up in that spirit, and Ajahn Chah would put a lot of emphasis on things like contentment, just being content with what one has. And of course, Warapanya tells a great story of where he is staying in a particular kuti, and then Ajahn Chah would always, once you've been assigned a kuti, then just stay in that kuti and be content with it, look after it, take care of it. There's always occasions for changing kuti is one goes off somewhere and you leave one, your kuti, and you come back. And you end up with a new kuti. But the Warapanya sort of had his eye on another kuti that he built, because I think it was during hot season, and he had this one particular kuti that he thought it was going to be a bit cooler than the kuti he was in. And it's kind of Ajahn Chah and his understanding people's temperaments. And he explained to Warapanya that how important it is to be content with the dwelling place that you're in, and I said, because Warapanya had given him he'd given his pitch for changing kutis, and then Ajahn Chah said, "Well, I can see how important you're feeling that it is, and so I'll let you. You can go ahead and use that kuti in the daytime, but you can spend the night in your kuti." So it is like giving Warapanya something to. It's like they really got something from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah made a concession to him. Of course, he didn't realize that he sort of spent his days sort of carrying stuff back and forth between two kutis and finally getting fed up with that and just staying in his old kuti. So sometimes, Ajahn Chah, rather than this sort of saying, "No, you have to do this or you can't do that," and put it in a way that where you experiment with it and then you see for yourself, "Oh geez, it's a lot of hassle. Like if it was just content, it wouldn't be a problem wherever I was." And so that those lessons are important lessons to understand, rather than and hopefully lessons that are being learned through the applying of the different protocols and trainings that we take on. I remember one time a monk who was Aranyabho he's a very restless monk, and he'd disrobed once and went back to England, and he came back to reordain, and he was only maybe a couple punsas, and he was just incredibly restless and then Ajahn Chah, normally you wouldn't go on Tudong until you were at least five punsas. And Ajahn Chah sort of gave Aranyabho the opportunity to go on Tudong. And Aranyabho was just so over the moon. But he said, "If you're going to go to Tudong, you have to do it. You have to do it right, and not sort of traveling here, traveling there. You have to make some determinations for yourself, so that if you're going to go Tudong, then go Tudong, go walk. Don't take any rides, and don't stay in any place more than 3 days." And at that point, Aranyabho was happy to agree to anything just to get out of the monastery. He was. And then as, I don't know, maybe a month or so later, because it was hot season, and Runyabo comes back in, back to Wat Bapong. And I said, "Wow, how'd you make out?" And he said, "Zada Jan Cha, he tricked me again." That was the most awful experience. I'm just so happy to be back. Just walking all the time in the hot sun, in the hot season. It was no fun at all. So that, he came back. He was happy to be back at Wat Bapong. It was a useful opportunity. But those sorts of, kind of practices and trainings are ways that we can be learning how to look more closely at intention, volition, habits. What are the habits of mind? What are the habits of speech? What are the habits of our actions? What are the things that actually lead to benefit, to peace, to in accordance with Dhamma? What are the things that really aren't, even though they may be couched in some bias or preference or ideal or whatever? But what are the results of our actions? What are the results of our the assumptions that we have in our minds? So this is a quality that comes into the meditation, because if we're not really in, it's not a matter of, say, in meditation, you sit down cross-legged, pay attention to one, an in-breath and out-breath, in-breath and out-breath, and then all of a sudden you become peaceful, enter the jhanas. And then once you do that, then of course wisdom comes and enlightenment and it's all over. It isn't how it works. One has to learn how to investigate. One has to learn how to understand the habits of the mind. One has to learn and see clearly what works, what doesn't work, what are the obstacles in practice. What are the things that actually support and encourage the aligning with Dhamma, the steeping oneself in Dhamma, being able to delight in the Dhamma, that Dhamma Chanda Dhamma Piti, that desire for the Dhamma and the delight in the Dhamma. And those are qualities that need to be nurtured in many different ways. And that having the props, having the tools, having the external conditions are a huge support for practice. And but then we have to really learn and understand for ourselves. So that's a reflection this morning.